Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
We've run these two ARGs, one in the lead up to Atlas Rising and now this one, which have been really popular, like 300,000 people playing the first one, 400,000 people playing this one. And that's our way of communicating now with the community, or it has been, right? And I used to joke when we started up the ARG that we ran these because we had basically been banished to the astral plane. And we could only talk to the community through, like, moving things on a table, or they would ask if a certain feature was in the game, and we would, like, kick the door or something. Those are the words of Sean Murray in a piece that went up today on Waypoint called "We Spent an Hour Talking to Hello Games About Everything No Man's Sky." That was an interview conducted, of course, with the two other people on this call. And, of course, this is Waypoint Radio 171. Joining me today, of course, is Austin Walker.
Hi.
And Patrick Klepek.
Hi.
How you guys doing? You did quite an interview.
It's Friday, so yeah. I'm doing okay. I'm finally, it's almost done.
We almost survived the week, which
just
is
about.
Helpful, and yeah. It's good. And I figured, since we had a really great feature this week, one really great sort of shining piece that we had go up on the site, I figured that was probably a good topic for us to talk about, No Man's Sky and what happened with No Man's Sky, which is what you talked to Sean Murray about.
Totally. Plus, there's like
Murray?
A lot of jumping off
Murray
points.
Or Murray?
Murray.
Murray?
Murray.
Murray. Murray.
Mr.
Murray.
Murray.
That's
Murray?
Right. Murray.
Murray.
Sean.
Murray.
Sean Murray.
Sean M.
It's funny because like I kept thinking his name. I kept seeing his name being like, that's not right. Is that right?
Really?
It's like a weird block in my head. It was just like it wasn't rolling off my tongue the right way. I was like, but of course I know his name. Like it was super weird. But yeah, we have an interview up on the site if you haven't seen it yet, as Danielle mentioned, waypoint.advice.com.
9,500.
That's too many. It's a lot of words.
It's not 9,500.
Patrick, it is 9,500 words. It's 9,500 words.
It is 9,500.
And I was like, that's not.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a lot of words.
I mean,
yeah.
It was a conversation. It's a lot easier to go over on words than to sit and write 9,500 words.
We didn't write 9,500 words.
Right,
exactly.
That's true.
Exactly.
That's true. That's certainly true. But it is a good, meaty conversation. Yeah. You guys tackle a lot. I mean, let's talk about maybe a tiny bit of where this came from. Obviously, it's not a new game, but Next is very much feels like a major, massive update to this game. And in some ways, it almost feels like... not a sequel, but...
No, but like a 2.0?
Yeah,
like
2.0. A rebooting?
Yeah, or a reboot. It does feel like a reboot, right? Because it's coming out on Xbox One
For the first time on that platform.
Right, yeah. And it's coming out with this update in it already, which means like if you were just starting now, it's like, oh, wow, I'm getting the version of this game that has a bunch of stuff that was just not there at all. And so it is like it does feel like an opportunity for them for on the other platforms, on PlayStation and on PC, to also just kind of like, hey, we're going to make new things that can maybe bring you back to the game. Big picture, like from what the trailer they released last week, if people haven't seen that yet and are curious, it's like multiplayer is the big one, which Sean confirmed to us is like you and three of your friends or like – four people per a sort of instance, right?
I think it's just four
people.
Which
can mean like random journey style
interactions
occasionally. He described a moment where he like ran into someone at a trading post and was like, whoa, shit, there's a person here, which was really good. This whole new system around having like a whole armada of freighters, basically. Where you're like, or frigates, you have a freighter and then you have a team of frigates that he compared to the assassins in Assassin's Creed 2 Brotherhood. You send them out and they go do stuff. And then like a whole collection of like visual enhancements, character customization, and then third person, which is also huge, especially if you're, you know, like some of my friends who like get sick playing first person games, or who like just can only play them for an hour or two. Being able to be in third person, and also just like cool
just
to see your fucking shit,
right?
For yeah, it's an option.
Point in
yes.
the game, you
first
can
just or third,
switch that out.
Gotcha. And it's cool to just like, oh wow, yeah, you see your ship doing cool roles instead of just first person stuff, you know. And so yeah, we had the opportunity to talk to him about that, but also about just hey. Yo, what happened?
What went down? So I guess to tee this up, if folks weren't around a couple of years ago.
Sure.
No Man's Sky was hyped quite a bit. It was it became a game that Sony was hyping quite a bit at their E3 for a couple of years. I think 2015 was like the massive push.
That was when Sean was on stage.
He was
and
on
like
stage, yeah.
Did
yeah.
a live gameplay demo. But it had been on there, I think 2014 they showed gameplay also. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was
yeah.
announced in
2013, the very, very end at the Game Awards?
At VGX at the
time.
Or was
it VGX?
It was still VGX,
yeah,
gotcha. Yes. Gotcha. So that was the year that Keeley and what's-his-face from Community?
Oh, yeah, okay.
The hell's his name?
The guy who...
The guy Talk Soup host? The little
yes.
Talk Soup host? What's his name? Oh, my God. This is...
Joel McHale.
Joel McHale.
Joel McHale.
Thank you,
Natalie.
You could have just said it.
That.
You could have just said it out loud. She's like making mouth shapes at me.
Mouth sounds. Joel McHale.
Joel McHale. And Joel McHale was just like such a downer. Who's just like, yeah, video games. I guess if someone cares about those, we'll show those off. But then the No Man's Sky trailer came out and he's like, wow, six people are making this, huh? Fuck. Okay, that looked pretty cool. And I think from there, like, people were really excited. But a lot of the features that came up during developments, during trailers, including during live demos, ranging from, you know, the crashed freighters on the surface of planets to multiplayer, to a giant sandworm, which was
multiplayer,
important.
I think, was a big
sandworm
point
slash snake. Yeah, to faction conflict, all sorts of stuff was at various points gestured at or said. And as is the case with most games, over the course of development, things changed. And I think the thing that came out, one of the things that came out in conversation with Sean was like, yeah, we shouldn't have shown what we had because it was liable to change. And there's that Kanye West line in Don't Tell Me Nothing, which is like, I'm on TV talking like it's just you and me. And it's like, you can't do that. That's not, your job is not, you're not, we're not hanging out at the bar.
Right.
We are, you know, you're pitching me a product.
Right.
And, you know, I think that by the end of that game's life cycle, Sean had gotten out there and said, like, oh, yeah, there's not multiplayer in the way you think. Okay, here's what this game is. And enough press had played it a little bit to be like, okay, I think we know what this is now. It's a survival game. So
comes
I kind
out
of,
about, what, 2 years ago? Almost exactly.
Almost exactly. August 2016. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
Early August. And so by then – it had built up this huge, like, hype.
The forever game.
The forever game.
I think that was a term that was thrown around
that
nobody will ever need another game again because, again, the pitch on
this
game is that there are millions and millions of planets. It's procedurally generated, so there's, like, endless, infinite content.
And then it comes out and, like, you know, the ship combat isn't good or necessary ever. And it's a survival game. It's like Minecraft but in space with like bright colors. And the animals aren't doing anything that's like particularly interesting. And for me, despite all of that, it was still something I liked a lot. It was a great relaxing tool. I liked exploring the worlds and kind of taking in the vistas. I liked the exploration stuff and the kind of scavenging and salvaging stuff. But for a lot of folks, like it felt like they'd been sold a bill of goods, which to some degree is fair. Up until a point, which is like I think a lot of people pulled the trigger on their purchase way too early, which it was a huge conversation at the time about pre-orders and stuff like that. So, you know, one of the things that was great is like finally getting to talk to Sean about all of that stuff because after the game came out, Sean went radio silent. The game, the Hello Games continued to support the game and update the game over the course of the last 2 years. They put out three big updates, one that added base building, one that added like vehicles and I want to say like –
there's some more story stuff in there.
Well, the third
one
was the story stuff.
Actually, that
was the
third one. Yeah.
And then like gestures at multiplayer. Like it basically would – you would see other players as little floating lights in the world and like a 30-hour story campaign.
Yeah.
And so between all of those things, it gets become a game and freighters. You can pilot freighters now. There are crashed freighters on the ground now. So bit by bit, they've been adding stuff that was either explicitly promised or shown off on a stage or stuff that was implied early on in some interview and then clarified along the way. But all of that was done without Sean Murray being out there, who became sort of a spokesman for the game even though the team grew in size, right? Like it started with – he was the first programmer on it. Then it became four people, then six, then 15 by launch. Now it's 25. And so this is the first time he was making the rounds again as a kind of spokesman for the game. And it's like, hey – like, I'm really happy. I mean, Patrick, I'm curious how you think that conversation went. Because on my side, I was like, okay, we get to ask pretty much everything I wanted to ask. Not everything. There's always more, but all the big stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I've talked to Sean a number of times in the past. I was part of that, like, No Man's Sky promotional tour. And, like, there's a bit in there where he discusses, you know, some of the reaction from the press when they would meet with Hello Games or with Sean specifically. There'd be other team members, but you're usually having an interview with Sean, yeah, like they were very, like they let their guard down. They spoke in a way that, you would wish you could talk to more developers, where they just said what they wanted to say and, said it in a very honest, way that you don't feel like you get out of a lot of developers. And, that like really bit them in the ass in a way that, like it is both their fault and is also like, it's 50% their fault, 50% like naivete, or maybe like, and then there's some like 25% Sony should have stepped in and like helped guide them because they know better. And the fact that like Sony was riding No Man's Sky's coattails to financial windfall means that they probably should have stepped in to like do the thing that a publisher is supposed to do the thing that a big company like that has prior relations with the press and knows how meetings go. So I thought it was a really interesting conversation. You see a lot of through lines between the three major interviews that he did. He did one with the Eurogamer, he did one with the Guardian, and those were all like really terrific interviews as well. And I think like sort of the through line you see in it is a person realizing that they were accidentally thrust into a role of a public relations spokesperson, discovered sort of after the fact that they weren't very good at it. And I wouldn't necessarily argue that he's bad at it. I think he's very good at articulating like the vision for No Man's Sky, like the passion that studio has, and advocating on behalf of the developers that he represents as their spokesperson for the studio as a whole. But you know, learning the hard way, like where you're supposed to stop yourself, like learning the hard way where you're supposed to temper expectations, like learning the hard way, all these other things. And so we watch someone learn that in real time, and part of the reason it lands better and is more interesting through these interviews is because the game is better. Like the game, like it's still, I don't think the game that I want to play, but that's not because it's a bad game. It's just not a game that I want to play. But I don't think you can look at the last couple of years of No Man's Sky and whatever faults you may want to continue to hold against them. You can't say they didn't make good in the last couple of years on trying to turn that thing around and really hit upon a closer version of what people maybe had built up in their head prior to that game's release.
I really want to talk a little bit about some of the stuff you were talking there in the beginning. I'll just read a tiny little piece here where he's talking about talking to press, talking about going into interviews. So really, we should have been in a more scripted mindset. I look back on those interviews and they're vague and rambling, kind of like this. And he sort of laughs at himself. That's my natural way of talking. I can feel that I'm already rambling. This is why I shouldn't talk to anyone. He laughs again. But this is the real meat of it. We would talk to press. We would talk to people like yourselves at E3 or whatever. And they'd be like, oh, it's so nice to sit down with developers and just chat about things and chat about games in general. And the communities react really well to it. Sean's cool. He just talks about games. He seems like a normal person. It's so nice. It's not those scripted PR. And you guys would be like, why don't publishers just have this? And I'm like, yeah, I don't know. Now I 100% get it. I've got some advice for past Sean. So it's like a really, it's both a really heartening thing to see as, you know, somebody who does this side of it as well. Like, it is nice when you go to E3 and you talk to, say, indie developers or PAX or wherever you go, and you talk to developers who are very honest, right, and very unguarded about their games. Right. Like, I've always really enjoyed that and really appreciated that, just kind of shooting the shit with people, talking about game design, talking about this sort of thing.
But being earnest is a trick, right? So
yeah, like, of course. Yeah.
I am incredibly earnest and honest and transparent, seemingly, on this podcast, on Twitter, on Instagram, like wherever, right? Like it's all, like there is being unguarded, and then there's performative unguarded, and
right.
What Sean has learned or is learning is like what performative Unguarded is, right? It's like being he's very good at spinning answers, and spinning makes it sound like pejorative, but like he gives really interesting answers, like very articulate answers. But like you have to have an internal calculus over that stuff too. And like that's the performance part of an interview or being on a podcast or whatever the venue is when you are doing something that it is in a semi-public space. Like speaking to a reporter is a semi-public space. And like just watching someone talk about hitting the hiccups on that and learning that is fascinating.
There's also a scale. Yeah, definitely. And there's also like a scale issue here too, right? If I go to the indie mega booth and I talk to two folks who are making a game and it is a smaller scale game, it is a different mindset than somebody being up on a stage at E3, right? Or being sort of, you know, featured by Sony in this massive, giant, mega way. Like it is such a different experience. And it almost seems to me as if Sean is coming from or was coming from more of that smaller scale sort of experience, or like, you know, being on a small team at the time, being six people or whatever it was when they were first working on this game, to then being like, oh, it's still a small team, but also we have to fulfill this like massive promise that is now millions of people have seen this, like millions and millions of people have these expectations. And that is actually fascinating and not actually, I think, a super common story that we see much of in our industry, right? Like we don't see this process happening of a person going from, you know, really a behind-the-scenes engineer-style kind of developer to being like, oh, you're the PR person now. Also, you're the spokesperson. Also, you're on stage in front of millions of people.
Right.
Like, also, that is not necessarily the most common path.
Right. Well, like, and that's the team that made Joe Danger 1 and 2.
Yeah.
Right? And I'm not dissing Joe Danger. Stunts are cool. Motorcycles, also cool.
Smaller game.
Yeah. And the stakes are lower, right? Like, Joe Danger may have one day showed up on an ID at Xbox, you know, what do you call it? Like a rapid fire video montage, right?
But it was 4 seconds of footage.
Right. Like, oh, wait, that's Joe Danger. Sick. You know,
yeah.
But like, you know, if Joe Danger 2 was supposed to have motorcycles and now also stunt boats and also hang gliders, and the hang gliders got pulled before release, no one is going to – like someone is going to throw a fit. But by and large, that response is not going to be – there's going to be a huge backlash to Joe Danger 3. The hang gliders didn't fucking make it in. Like
right.
The stakes were so much lower. And also Joe Danger is a game that explains itself very clearly. It's an arcadey, stunny, you know, game where
the scope of that game
is
I'm not trying to say limited as in it's like a super simple game, but it's focused. Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
And it's clear from watching someone play it for two stages, like, oh yeah, Joe Danger, I get it. I get what that game is. No Man's Sky was not that. And I will say that I think that part of the disconnect is that came up here. And like I've gone back now and looked at some old interviews. I've rewatched all of the trailers and all of like the stage presentation stuff. Is that so much of what is going on? So much of what the game is trying to get at is a sense of mystery, and that doesn't mean that it has mysteries in it. And so there are things that he said and things he didn't say in interviews that were about that sense of mystery. So like if you go read, there's a Game Informer article from 2014 in which the subject is like, don't expect multiplayer from No Man's Sky, which is like, they published that in 2014, and yet people still expected multiplayer from No Man's Sky. And in that interview, there are moments where what Sean Murray, what anybody else would have said, and not anybody else, but what other devs in that situation would have said, like, oh yeah, we're not going to add multiplayer in by the time it ships. And instead, what we get is like, you know, the universe is really big. It's very unlikely you're going to see anybody, and if you do, it'll be this very brief thing. And, you know, he's gesturing at a thing that he talked about in our interview today or that went up today about the sort of like, hey, we're trying to make space – you know, 2001 A Space Odyssey, not Star Wars. And we're trying to make something tonal. We're trying to make something contemplative, not something that's filled with action and stuff. And so this interview is so wild. It's because it's just like, and I'm not dissing the interviewer here, because the interviewer is doing their job of like trying to get an answer to this. Where it's like, will your friend show up on the map? And Sean's like, yeah, but they'll be a far way away. You're not going to run into them, right? And it's like, okay, well, it seems like it's like a high risk to incorporate that because you know, why would you even, if you're going to incorporate it, were you never going to see anybody? And Sean's like, yeah, it's okay for it to never happen. If it happens, it'll be very, very, very light. So how many people could it be? How many could it be theoretically? And it's like, I don't want to say the number because who is like, okay, well, will your friends take priority in that lobby? And it's like, oh, just Sean, just say it's not a multiplayer game or we have multiplayer in it, but it's at a testing phase. We can't commit to it right now. Right. We'd love to get it into the game.
We'll have more to announce closer to launch.
To launch. There you go. That's all. That's all. That's all.
That's what you do. Like, instead, he was doing a lot of answers that were like literally probably explaining some of their thought processes they were working through.
Right.
Their design goals and the practicalities of what they were making. And I mean, I think this is illustrative. This like ties into like some of the cyberpunk stuff we were talking about at E3, like, you know, CD Projekt Red's decision to not release their demonstration for a game they said was in like early alpha because they got burned on The Witcher 3 and the way that people picked apart, like, oh, like, you know, Witcher 3 had a similar situation, No Man's Sky, not quite at the same scale, but one in which people were picking apart old promises, in this case, the fidelity. Dark Souls 2 actually had this same issue when it came to the lighting. Like, there's a huge controversy over Dark Souls 2's lighting. Like, go look up some YouTube videos and find some outrage there. Like, there's a reason developers don't usually talk so frank. Because, like, what do they get out of it, right? Like, what do they ultimately get out of being honest and transparent about where they're at in a process? Like maybe, like, the reporter often feels like they're getting something more interesting, but to the, like, quote-unquote gamers, like, have shown they can't really be trusted with this information. Like, they don't have the ability to put it in context. Like, and I'm painting with a very broad brush, but, like, generally speaking, people have shown an inability to understand, why a game can change. A game can change, and not holding that against the developer because it's not a promise. It's just a statement. And that's not to excuse. Cause I think Hello Games did, like, play into this. Like, once it was already a thing, they continued to play into it as a thing in a way that did feel slightly disingenuous. Nonetheless, like, you know, people have not shown that if they were actually given full transparent access to how a game was made, that they'd be able to really handle how that process goes.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like, a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Right, totally. I mean, I think that is so much of... I don't say like what's at stake, because what we're talking about at the end of the day is like this game made by a small team either would or would not come out, either would or would not be a big financial success. And I obviously want everyone in their artistic pursuits to be fulfilled or whatever, right? But it is interesting for me, you know, I guess the coda I'm saying there, or the kind of qualifier I'm saying is like, I know this is not the end of the world. I know that this is not like high on our list of political concerns or anything like that. But I do want the world of games to be a place where, one, consumers and players and you know, budding developers understand what game development looks like, yeah, and how things can change over the course of time. And two, a place where those sorts of changes and risk-taking, the sort of risk-taking and ambition – is applauded, and then when they fuck up, it's okay for that project to fail and to just not support it, but it doesn't also have to become, and then you send them bomb threats.
Right?
Which is the thing that happens here from the Eurogamer, I believe it was the Eurogamer or the Guardian interview, revealed that, like, yeah, they'd receive bomb threats, like, over not having crashed frigates at their freighters in the game. Like, are you fucking kidding me, right? That it's there's such a chilling effect on ever wanting to talk openly about your game right now until it's ready to go. And even with us, there was a moment where he like starts to get his eyes bright. You know, he's describing, I kind of have to call him on it for a moment. Right?
Towards the end. I think I know exactly what you're talking about.
It's the pirate bit, right? Here it is. He goes like, over the last 2 years, now especially with Next, every part of it's becoming deeper. That's really exciting. And it's becoming broader as well. It's weird. When you see multiplayer and you see the scale of it and you see we've got unlimited base building and you can command a set of frigates, you can live out so many different science fiction fantasies all within this universe sandbox that we've built. That's really exciting. And for more people, each time we update the game, it becomes their hopefully perfect game or the game they've wanted to play forever or whatever it is. That's the fun thing to do. And it's like he's speaking so honestly about the game, but that is the sort of language that has those gaps that are waiting to be filled by the listener.
Got him in trouble last time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the thing that's frustrating is that that does get him in trouble because I would like there to be a world in which artists can say stuff like, then you can command a set of frigates could mean anything, right? And yes, it would be good if that product ships. If on Monday I open that, I start playing that game or Tuesday, whenever it is, and it's like, oh, there's no frigates in here. Like, all right, well, dude, you just told me that there are going to be frigates in this thing. There aren't frigates. I'm not commanding shit. That's a real problem. And that's like, that, okay, he's lying to me. But there should be something different between that and a year ago when he's like painting this picture for what the game is and it releases and doesn't have those things. It's like, okay, it's been a year since that happened. Should the company have gotten out there or the developer gotten out there and been like, hey, we got rid of that stuff? Probably. But I don't know what the venue is for that. And that he brings that up too with the snake, which is like, should we have released a – there was an early trailer of that game that reveals like a giant
– a big Dune
like a
Dune-style
sandworm.
Yeah.
And they removed it or they turned it into like a flying worm instead because on the ground it just wasn't fun. So do we run a – like a press release, like, hey, we got rid of the sandworm.
No more sandworms and No Man's Sky. Like, it's
I mean,
so...
that's they shouldn't have gone silent for 2 years.
No,
like they made a I was going back and forth with someone on Twitter today where they were still sort of they liked that they were making the game better, but they were still like genuinely upset over like the fact that they shipped this game and then in a way disappeared without sort of explaining like the rockiness of the launch and what happened with some of these issues. And as I was thinking through it with them, you know, I landed on, I don't think Sean trusted himself anymore to be that person to explain it. And between the harassment and the threats and the fact that he had shown an inability to show the sort of restraint that was required to sell the game in the way that you just sort of have to in like the way people were specifically responding to this game, that the most responsible thing to do was to just say nothing, focus on the game, and then come back once you've kind of cleared your head. Because if you just came back immediately, like in the middle of all of that, would it necessarily have improved anything? I don't know. I do think it was still a mistake to not say anything. I think what the team probably should have done was put out like a big statement, you know, put it in an image with some fancy No Man's Sky artwork and like do a little bit of a mea culpa for what happened and then say like, you know, 500 words and then say, and now we're going to go heads down and improve No Man's Sky and then go disappear.
Or do what he suggested, which is like have the roadmap. All right, here's where the game is at launch. We know things are missing. We know things that last year
are our stretch goals.
Right. Well, except
not even, in terms of money, but in terms of like, okay, in terms of time.
Totally.
Basically.
Like last year at Sony and in 2015, they opened that. This is maybe the one of the ones where I'm like, oh, this is the worst one. Like as someone who likes this game and as a No Man's Sky apologist and can speak honestly and genuinely about how much that game means to me, when I see Sean on stage open a sequence where he like gets into a fight in space with like a bunch of different capital ships and the ships are fighting each other and he's like, we're at a border between two factions and this is like the front line as they fight and I can decide to support one side or the other. There's like nothing like that in that game. Even 2 years later, there's nothing like it. Like, yes, you can attack capital ships in that game and pirates occasionally will, but there's no like faction interaction and you can gain reputation with different factions and all that stuff too.
Yeah.
But there are no right now lines drawn in space between these large factions that you're contributing in a fight with.
It's clearly simplified.
It's not just simplified. It's gone. It's not, there isn't there at all. And so when if I'm a player at home who's like the fantasy that I'm mapping on is armchair admiral, you know, is I'm going to help push the space robots away and the space little turtle people.
You're Rob.
Right. Exactly. If I'm playing as Rob, I'm seeing that demo a year ago and being like, okay, I can feel, okay, I can see what this is. In the same way that for me, the gaps that I was filling was like, man, I'm going to see a bunch of cool fucking planets. They only showed me 2 planets, 3 planets, 4 planets, but I bet you there's like, I'm going to see like 7 dozen good planets. And it turned out that my supposition from what they showed was right. And it's a big part of why I came into that game where my hype was sated. Whereas if you're coming at it from the like, okay, they said on a stage that there were faction interactions of that sort, like that one to me is so much – that sort of thing was so much more distinct. And also it didn't feel genuine in the way that Sean sometimes can when he's talking in this mysterious way. When Sean talks about, oh, the multiplayer is going to be this thing where like, did you even pass someone in the night? Like, we're not going to put player names above their heads or anything. We don't want to show – like, okay, who knows if that's going to be in or not, but I get what you're going for there. When you watch that footage of him on a stage being like, and now I'm going to get into some space combat. It's like, oh, you're ticking the fucking box. You're making this game way more appealing. And I don't know who said you should go do that. I don't know if that was an internal thing from him and No Man's Sky or from Hello Games. I don't know if that was a Sony thing saying, hey, people really want to see space combat. Show them the juiciest, most ambitious, aggressive thing that you can, that That'd you think guess. You'll make.
Yeah.
That's my guess.
Yeah.
But like, that was one of those ones where it's like, okay, like that is – I don't think that was a lie in the sense that I think he believed that they would have that system in by launch and they didn't. And so I can imagine the player who's like, well, is that stuff there? I don't know. I'll just buy it anyway. And like that sucks and that's really tough. But I want to find the middle ground between those things so that as fans you can both want to take the risk or support work that's taking risks, support work knowing that what you saw a year, 2 years, 3 years ago could be completely different than what you're buying, but also where we are able to say like, okay, well, what's a big promise look like? What's a little promise look like, you know?
So I just want to ask this. I don't know if this is really completely on base as a comparison, but it is something I've been thinking about a lot since reading this interview and thinking about something like around 10 years ago, we had a lot of overpromising from somebody like Peter Molyneux or even like Dennis Dyack talking about the one console future. And we had game developers who were overpromising the moon in their games. But the response seemed to be more of a, oh, that's Peter Molyneux going off. You know, there's the Peter Molyneux Twitter account that was like fake, ridiculous game ideas and overambitious things. Like it seemed like the reaction to those types of things. And I'm not saying that neither of them have ever received a death threat. I'm sure they have. If you're in a public persona whatsoever in you know, in the modern era, I'm sure you've received a death threat. But it feels like the reception to that sort of overpromising and underdelivering is so much more toxic now than it was, you know, even just a few years ago. This is still the modern era. I'm not talking about like, you know, 1927 or anything here, right? This is like 10 years ago that we're talking about. And I don't know if either of you feel that, if there's any like valid comparison there or there's any sort of idea there or anything has actually really changed. But it definitely feels to me as if things have gotten more toxic in that regard.
Patrick, I'm curious your thoughts there.
Well, I mean, I you know, it's easier for people to whip each other into a frenzy. I mean, I think we see that with almost anything. I don't think that's exclusive to games. I don't think that's exclusive to No Man's Sky. I mean, I think that is just part of the internet. That's part of Reddit. That's part of 4chan. That's part of YouTube. That's part of Twitter. Like it is easier to get whipped into a frenzy. And so things that might've just kind of blown over in the past have more of a tendency to like gain steam, gain collective and, be aimed. That's just a pretty natural tendency. I don't see that getting any better. That seems like that's only going to get worse. It's just more of a matter of like how you react and control and constrain that. And I think part of what No Man's Sky ran into was that it looks like a AAA game, but it was made by a smaller developer.
Right.
Yeah.
And we are pretty well trained at this point that when you see a trailer for Gears of War, like what you see is more or less what you're going to get, right? Like that when the trailer they're putting out is being put out with purpose, and that like what they are showing you is because they've thought this through, like whether you like it or not, like you sort of, there's a face value aspect of AAA games by the nature of their development. And where No Man's Sky like blurred this line by looking like the kind of thing you expected from like a high production or a big sort of like a resource studio, but was coming from a tiny team that had never made something like this before. Yeah. I think people took more of it at face value, took the interviews at face value, because you've been trained to take the trailers at face value, to take interviews at face value. And so when those things became consistent, when they didn't line up, it was exponentially worse because the gap between those things was so much bigger than when something changes in a AAA game, right? Like when something is shown in a Halo or whatever, like, and it's not in the final product, it's not nearly as big relative to the things that people were upset about or the things that were missing in No Man's Sky. Some of the things missing from No Man's Sky felt fundamental or elemental to the game that people had expected was coming. And so, like, No Man's Sky, in being, like, more honest and transparent than we're used to, like, messes with people's expectations and, like, created this gap. And, like, again, that's where I put a lot of this on Sony, because they should have been the responsible party to step right in and be like, they were seeing this game. They were looking yep. at milestones.
Yep.
They knew this developer. They may not have been, like, calling, you know, every shot that Hello Sky was doing or Hello Games was doing, but, like, they were deeply familiar with No Man's Sky, and I do think Sony got greedy. I think Sony decided to just run with it, and I think it was irresponsible what they did relative to the naiveness of Hello Games. Like, this isn't, again, like a removing culpability from Hello Games for their own faults, but I do think there was a responsible partner in the room, and they failed at, like, their primary thing, which is being a partner that steps in and goes, whoa, okay.
Okay,
all bro. Right.
Hey, like, you're all right, six we're, people.
We're a year away from release. We gotta put walls up around this game so people right. understand, like, where the walls are. They can start understanding what it is. But, you know, it was to Sony's benefit for people to not know. Maybe that's more cynical than the reality, but looking the other way certainly worked in Sony's favor.
Well, I mean, at the very least, you can say, like, Sony has a responsibility as that game's publisher on PlayStation to, like, step in. And if they didn't do it because they thought that they'd be getting more hype or more sales or whatever, that's bad. And it's also bad if they were just negligent. If they just saw and were, or, like, they weren't keeping a close eye on the project. They weren't all, you know, all that stuff. I'll say also, I think part of the difference between something like Fable overpromising and this overpromising is
he knew better. There's a pattern.
One, you know better. Two,
he did.
Two, there is ProcGen is such a like a question mark, and I think I've said this before, maybe on this podcast, but, like, if you don't know what procedural generation is capable of at any given moment, if you haven't been, like, paying attention to the Tarn Adams and the Tanya Shorts and, like, the people in the space who do proc gen studies and, like, who are at the forefront of figuring out, and Mark, you know, I said Mark Jacobs, but that's Mark Johnson, who's making Ultima Ratio Regum, like, the people who are making this stuff have communicated, if you're in those spaces, what the limits of proc gen are. And so, you know, in Gears of War, let's say you see a dinosaur. You're like, yo, shit, there's a dinosaur? There's going to be a dinosaur stage? Word? Okay, cool. I'm going to see a dinosaur. And then if that's a dinosaur stage, I bet there's 12 other levels and each one has a different thing that really feels different and distinct. And you can count on that. And what you will also think is, like, and then all those other creatures aren't just going to look like tweaked versions of that same creature. And that's not the case with No Man's yeah. Sky. You will see multiple dinosaurs. You will see multiple goats. But, like, you can see the skeletal structure. And, you know, they showed that stuff off ahead of time. They did show what the limits and strengths of, like, the ship generation look like. But there is something about the sort of magic of the way it was pitched, which is, like, Sean just, like, flying you through millions and millions of stars. Like, there could be anything on those stars. Like, no, dog, it's going to be a forest. It's going to be an ice planet. It's going to be, like, floating forest ice planet. Some combination of some, like, 30 things, right? And it can be very easy to be like, well, this technology is so good that it's going to surprise me every time. And it isn't. And, like, I think right now, even No Man's Sky Next, there's going to be a lot of people who jump onto it thinking it's going to be something more than what it is. And it's still going to be basically this game, which, again, came up in this interview, which was like, he's at the point now where it's okay if you don't play this game, Patrick. He doesn't care if you don't play this game. because it might just not be for you, and that's okay. It's fine for there to be games that aren't for everybody, and this game is going to be able to find its strength by leaning in with the audience it has now and the fans who, now that they see what it is, actually can say, yes, that is a thing that I'd like, instead of trying to be everything for everybody. And I hope this is also a big learning moment for a lot of people with, like, what Proc Gen is, right? Like, it right now, at least, can't create you cities on infinite planets where there's, you know, dialogue written for people and reams of lore. And to get that stuff, you have to hire a writer. And that's what they did for the No Man's – for the Atlas Rises
for
update,
the story.
Right? And so, like, stuff like that is where it's, like, it's a learning lesson. This whole thing for me as a critic, as a fan, and as someone who, like, occasionally dips his toe in the creation of stuff, like, oh, yeah, okay. Like, scope your fucking game. Communicate what your game is. And don't trust that just because you and your friends understand what the game is, that the audience will too. There are going to be gaps that they fill in, and the sexier your technology is, the more like up and coming, the less they understand it. And because it's game dev, like, very few people really understand a lot of different pieces of technology or even just of, like, types of craft work. There's a lot of room for people to fill in that gap, and that can be detrimental to, like, getting your message across.
So, Austin, I know you asked a question about the politics of this game, and I'm really interested in how, I mean, from both of you, how you sort of reacted to Sean's response, which was very, like, we went through hell,
right,
you know, making this. It sucked. A lot of terrible things happened, but I want to believe in a better future. Like, okay. I'm very much paraphrasing here, but he kind of had that whole thing about wanting to have spectacle, wanting to have a hopeful vision of the future,
yeah,
even given everything that has sort of happened in the last few years.
Yeah.
So how did you react to that? To his,
that's what I,
like,
expected to some degree.
Okay.
Like,
but the game has politics, right? Like,
yes,
the game, the game's politics is optimism about,
yes,
technology. So it's like, it's not a, it's different than saying this game doesn't have politics. This game absolutely has a vision and an ideology. Like,
yeah,
just because it's not, like, immediately reflective of, like, a current moment doesn't mean,
right,
it has, doesn't,
it's
not, have something. It absolutely has something to say.
It's not trying to convince you to vote for the Green Party. But,
right,
like, that doesn't mean there's nothing politically. Like,
is Jill Stein out there? Is that where that $1 million went?
That's where it
She's
went.
She's really a Gek.
She's a Gek.
That's
you
what
know?
It is. Geks are green. I'm just going to put,
uh-huh,
it out there. Jill Stein might be a Gek.
You know, typical Gek are commonly corporate and plutocratic in their mannerisms, with many of their titles tied to trading or industrial-related terms. I don't know if it quite adds up, but, you know, I think that, like, obviously there is lore in that world. There are different species that do have different things. There's lots of questions about technology, lots of questions about determinism, and, you know, about whether or not we live in a simulation and blah, blah, blah. But there is just, like, aesthetically speaking, it's such a bright, hopeful game. It's a game that, like, understands exploration as being an innately positive thing, and colonization to some degree, that, like, we should go out there and make our marks on the world.
And strip mining new planets.
And strip mining new planets for stuff. I want to be clear, like, I think that there's nuance here. I think that, like, this versus a game, versus a 4X game, where what you literally are doing is, I'm going to go put a mining rig down on every world I can fucking find so that I can produce a war machine to crush my opponents and so that I can literally enslave their populations. Like, if you're playing Stellaris as a bad guy, that game encourages you in a much different way than this.
It's very different,
which is not to say that you can't be critical about this stuff either, because sometimes dressing something up to where it looks apolitical is actually a little bit more dangerous, or not dangerous is probably too strong, but more malignant or something, right? But what I do think is, like, there is this, like, the spirit of creation, the spirit of exploration, the spirit of human ingenuity, the spirit of collaboration. These things are good. That is the politics of this game. And, like, there is a lot there to work with, but fundamentally under it all is, like, there is good and there is hope and things can get better. And so when I asked him that question, it was just like, yo, the first trailer of this game came out in 2013, months before Gamergate, years before Brexit, before Trump. Not that there were not already bad things happening in the world. There absolutely were. But it was a different time for a lot of us, and a lot of things that were either personal or experienced personally or now experienced socially. A lot of things that were on, you know, deep in are now surface level. A lot of things that I think a lot of people thought were buried were in fact revealed to be very, very close to the top already. So, like, how do you keep it? And he's very much just like, you know, I believe in dreamers. Like, the people who like my game, they're dreamers. They're optimistic. They think the world could be a better place. And you know, didn't back down from it, which is like, yeah, okay, good. That's fine. That's an answer I want to hear, you know? I want to hear you say that is what you believe in, because that's what you believe in. And, like, and it shows in the work. So, yeah. You know, double down, I guess. What was really interesting to me, spinning from that a little bit, was, like, we did also ask him about crunch. Yes. and about work-life balance, and, you know, a lot of a version of the question we asked the companies at E3, which you even read that piece. That's up on our site now, too. We asked 12 different companies about how they fight crunch and work and support good work-life balance at E3 and or, you know, at home while we were at E3 is when we asked. If you haven't read that piece, that's good. So we asked a version of that question, and Sean's answer was like, listen, when we launch this game, yes, we absolutely crunch and it's regrettable. You wouldn't imagine what we would have given for an extra day. We used to sit around and go, what would you give for a week? What would you give for a week? My understanding is that, like, that team put a lot into that game.
Yeah.
They absolutely overworked themselves. And the thing about his response, one, I'm glad he just is like, yes, we did, and it's bad. That's like step number one, say it's bad.
Acknowledge that it sucks.
Acknowledge that it happens. Acknowledge that it's bad. The worst thing is like, oh, we, you know, passion, people, oh, you can't keep them out of the office. Ugh. Which is like such bullshit.
And also that it's him as like in a management role to like do better. But like it's his responsibility as like a management and studio culture to both admit it, set an example, and try to do better at it. But I think what you're going to get to is like part of the specific reason why they can do better by it is they made a bunch of money
They made a bunch of money off of No Man's Sky. And now he's like, every release that we make, we get better at this. We get better at managing ourselves. Presumably that means about deadlines and timelines and like figuring out when they're going to be able to you know, deliver builds and keep up with their goals. Without crunching. And he's like, it's still a problem. It's still a problem across the industry. We're trying to get better at it. And I think we can get better at it. But like, yeah, the way he got better at it, the way that team got better at it is they made bank on that launch, which, you know, I think it was Jeff over at Giant Bomb brought this up on their podcast this week. That was just like the weird thing about this game. One of the weird paradoxes, like ethical paradoxes or quandaries about this game is we don't get No Man's Sky next if ahead of No Man's Sky it's clear what that game is for as many people. It's abundantly clear that what this is the Long Dark but in space.
Yeah.
Right? This is a survival game in space. This is –
is that the difference between that game just being like
– No.
Ultra successful and mega successful? Like had a better idea, I don't know – like – I don't know that my takeaway from
do you actually think people – I don't know. I guess here's the thing. Right. We know it was successful. That's part of the thing that Sean mentioned. You look at the charts.
It continues to be
successful. It would have found an audience. But I don't think it would have found the audience it found that produces like, yeah, let's just keep doing this. Let's release 4 expansions for free. You know?
Right.
Like – it's a games as a service with no way to put more money in it.
Existed, but then they just would have – charged for like I think there's a world where that stuff still exists. I get it, I understand yeah. like the question you're posing, but I don't know if I draw the same conclusion
but let me extend it, which is they made enough money to where they can fix their fucking crunch problem by hiring up, presumably by being better in management and by more importantly by writing their own check. That's actually the most important thing. Is they didn't have — I mean, one of the things he said to us was like they literally had a deadline they could not move. It was not their — they could not choose to move it. There's a point at which you sign the contract, you have to deliver a thing, and that sucks. And so, like, obviously, I want the entire industry to move into a place where, like, those sorts of limits are, you know, I get that you sign a contract, but like, there is some way of making sure you don't sign contracts that are going to necessarily push you into crunch, and like, that something can be healthy enough to where that works. And I think, Patrick, one of the things that you suggested was just like, hey, this could have been an early access game. Today, this could have been an early access game. They would have gotten a cash injection that would have kept the ball running and would have been able to pay for people to like maybe not work themselves.
I think it would have solved literally everything.
Yeah,
me too. If there still would have been a blowback because people would have been kind of bummed out about what it was and what it wasn't. But the connotation of early access, just like from a narrative perspective, from like a psychological perspective, you go into that game differently. I mean, I think we had the same conversation on Sea of Thieves. Like, I think that game would have benefited from just a AAA publisher saying, yo, this game's not done, and we want you to help us figure it out. And then you cut the price by a little bit to make people feel better about their investment. I think it had No Man's Sky come out. I mean, when I asked the question, you know, Sean's response was to, I mean, he said it jokingly, but that, like, he was slightly insulted by the insinuation that by, you know, the game was not finished, but, like, yo, the game wasn't finished. And that part I do sympathize with. Like, yes, it shipped, but I do think it was in a state that people had a right to be upset or at least critical of. And I just think from a broader big picture perspective and for where that game has gone since, that early access would have just put a framework in people's minds for, like, you know, if they'd announced 6 months before it was coming out, like, look, we have two things we could do. We could delay this game by 18 months and, like, get it closer to where we want to be, or we're going to cut the price by, like, a third. It's, you know, it's, I don't know what that launch, the game launched at $60, probably, right?
I think it
did. Yeah, it did, 100%.
I think it did.
Yep. So, right, so let's say the game's 30 or 40, and it's like, hey, for people who are getting on the ground floor, like, know that we've got a lot of work to do, but we have this really cool framework and foundation, and, like, come help us figure out the rest of the game, and then by the time, like, if Atlas Rises became, all right, now we're going full price.
Yeah.
You know, we're hitting 1.0. Imagine the way people would have responded to that game differently. They literally couldn't have done that because they partner with Sony. Sony does not have an early access program, continues to not have an early access program for reasons that I assume must be related to the same reason I can't change my fucking name on PSN. I don't know why that doesn't exist. I think it's a weird oversight, but I do think that would have been helpful to that game because it was a prime candidate for that. You know, clearly that path was a path not picked, and it sounds like it was a path that wasn't possible for them. But I do think that would have changed a lot of things about the way people. It would have changed the way I looked at that game, just because it probably would have meant that I just wouldn't have touched it and just, like, watched some videos and, like, cool, I'll come back when next comes out. Right.
Totally, and that's fine.
First impressions mean a lot, and I think No Man's Sky made a very poor first impression.
Totally.
On a lot of people.
Yeah, it's such a funny, weird thing because we're also in the middle of this games as services thing, right? And you know, I play PUBG now and then. I dip in on Fortnite, but by and large, I'm not playing any other games as service games, right? I'm not playing Rainbow Six Siege. I'm not playing The Division at this point. I'm not playing any of the other Ubisoft games that you could list here, but, like, and that's I'm not playing a Madden or you know, sports games after my initial, like, run with them where I play through a campaign or whatever. And that makes No Man's Sky kind of special in that it's become a game as a service game. It doesn't have a way to monetize yet. We'll see if that changes. He just said no loot boxes or microtransactions in regards to, like, some of their ongoing content. He did say that during one of the interviews. But, like you were about to say, Patrick,
the next expansion is something they're going to
visual customization would be, feels so necessary. I mean, or it's, so it's
aesthetic stuff and also just, like, whatever is the thing next year, like, after next. Like, they're doing these weekly challenges. They're doing weekly content going forward.
Yes.
It sounds like they're going to have, like, a free pipeline that's like, okay, here's free stuff we're putting into the game. But I mean, especially the visual overhaul, like, the game doesn't look, like, fundamentally different, but it looks really good. Like, it looks a lot better than the game that you can download from Steam or PSN or XBL right now. And it seems like that's, like, them hitting what, you know, a 1.0, or, I mean, they may be calling it 2.0. I think for a lot of people it may feel like they're finally hitting 1.0, but, like, sort of regardless, my guess is they would be transitioning to charging, you know, $20 or something for whatever they do the next time. And I think at this point, like, having not played next, but, like, just having read about it and what I've seen and talking to Sean, I mean, I think they have made good on the faults that existed. They have made good on, like people should just start fucking letting go of, like, that anger. Like, just like, generally speaking, just, like, just let that anger go.
There's so, like, much to be angry about.
Yeah.
There's so much.
There's so much
I'm still
things.
Upset about No Man's Sky 2 years later. Like, find new things to be angry about. Like, there, like, are,
not,
so, there are better things to...
Not just joke. That, even. It's more specific than that. The specific thing with the bomb threat fucking came in because of butterflies. Because in one of the trailers, this is from the Guardian interview. I remember getting a death threat about the fact that there were butterflies in our original trailer and you could see them as you walked past them, but there weren't any butterflies in the launch game. I remember thinking to myself, maybe when you're sending death threats about butterflies in a game, you might be the bad guy.
I didn't get my pretty butterfly. Like, that is the most absolutely, like, that just sounds like the worst edgelord tantrum.
It's so much.
In the history of the universe. Like, you wanted a beautiful butterfly, so you threatened to kill human beings. Uh-huh. Like, just...
Which goes back to your thing, you know, that we talked about again and again and again, which is like, care for people. Like,
yes.
Recognize they're human beings.
God, just recognize the humanity in other people. God.
But I bet that threat doesn't happen without the escalation and connectivity of the internet that we've seen, right?
Like, yes.
One, you probably don't notice that butterfly's not in the game. Two, if you're not around to get whipped up by other people in a frenzy, like, I think this has like sort of a building block effect on people where, mm-hmm. like, when you do like find yourself in communities where like this is all everyone is talking about, like, it's not hard to see how this becomes your world or how something that small suddenly becomes of such vast importance or represents like something larger, but this
that
is the thing in front of you
that
like I can take action on, like, oh, all these motherfucking game developers that like just whatever, they bother me for X, Y, and Z, but here I've got them. Like, I've got this butterfly, and then it's so easy. It's easy to call in a bomb threat. That's the thing. Like, it's both easy to do. It's hard to get caught. There aren't a lot of consequences for it. And because actually it happens so often now, you know, it kind of just like filters off. And I think, you know, this is one of those consequences of the internet. And like, it's great that people can like find each other, but it's also terrible that people can find each other because when they do, then I think it leads to escalations like this where just like you see other people's rhetoric, you get caught up in that psychological mindset. And, you know, especially if you've got, you know, particularly vulnerable, psychologically vulnerable people, right? Like, if you've got people that are lonely or have whatever, like, you're at a point in your life where you can be more susceptible to these things, like, this fills the vacuum, right? Like, there's something, the kind of person that makes this kind of threat, like, there are other things
going
on.
Which I know you don't mean as an excuse, right?
No, like, I'm not excuse. I think it helps explain, not excuse.
Yeah, there's a degree to which this is the part of your life you can have a direct impact on is because
you can feel not in control, but as if you are absolutely supposed to be in control of this, and therefore you have this righteous rage. I'm saying righteous in giant air quotes, righteous rage against these SJW developers who have done this thing to you. Yeah.
In which, like, the real – whatever the real dilemma of your life is has been deferred or been, like, covered up by this other thing. And, in fact, often – there's just, like, such a fucked ideology at work here,
and this,
right?
This, you know, coming to these realizations this week after reading the Joel Bernstein piece.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about that a little
bit? Yeah, I think we should. It's a profile piece of – I forget his last name. Lane taking a second to actually look it up.
It is Lane Davis.
Lane Davis. A right-wing sort of blogger, YouTuber, who, you know, really spouted a lot of conspiracy theories, a lot of really nasty hate, stabbed his father to death. This is a longtime source for Joel Bernstein over at BuzzFeed, who would report on right-wing movements. He would report on sort of this whole social movement. And a lot of the other folks that he interviewed for this piece, who he worked with, I don't know how you could think this, but it clearly thought, how did he not know? It's all a game. It's all a game. It's all... You know, it's all for fun. It's all like whipping people into this sort of frenzy, this right wing ridiculous frenzy is a game and not something to be taken too seriously. It's for the lulls, like that sort of idea that is very dangerous and very terrifying. And that's only one thread in this piece. But it pertains to this sort of attitude that you're owed something by other people, and you have a right and you have a duty to be angry about it. And there was even somebody quoted in the piece who, you know, claimed he was a liberal or even, quote, a socialist until Gamergate came around, and then he felt as if his sort of calling in life was to make content being angry at the SJW. So it's tied in a really uncomfortable and really scary way, I think, to a lot of this. That sort of general central kernel of hate and kernel of righteous anger that people feel towards other people, or especially towards people on the internet.
Yeah, I just knocked this table. It's a great piece. It's a really fantastic piece. And I think it does start to get at some of what both of you were just talking about, in which the conditions of the world are obfuscated, your anger is displaced into a space where you have access, because it's so easy to feel like you do not have access politically, that you do not have access economically to change. And in fact, often the way the ideology works is to then make you demand that you continue to not have access to those things.
Yeah.
Right? And in the case of game development, like the thing in our space, the thing I come back to again and again and again is that a lot of people don't know what game development is and think that games just appear on shelves and think that, like, you know, however many people are working, if there's anything wrong with a game, it's because someone was lazy or because they were stupid.
Oh, it's always laziness, yeah.
Because they had an agenda. Right, exactly. And it never can ever be just like, oh, yeah, they didn't make a good one this time. They overestimated their ability. They underestimated they had wrong perception of what the audience wanted. And there I'm not even just talking about No Man's Sky. I'm talking about like games in general. Right. And that doesn't mean you need to be soft as a critic. It doesn't mean you need to like be like, oh, well, you know, real people made this, so I shouldn't say it's a bad game. But it's like, oh, it's a bad game. All right, I guess I won't buy it. Like the end of the conversation, right? Like which it's so frustrating that we're still having that very fundamental, very baseline. Hey, this is how you move through the world, you know?
Here's how to be a human being,
yeah,
who isn't just horrible.
I listen to so many bad albums a year. So many disappointing albums. Chance the Rapper put out 4 songs this week. I don't like any of them.
No. Oh, no, really? I haven't listened to them yet. Oh.
Yeah, I don't like any of them. I don't like...
Fuck.
They're all right. They're all right. Like, if they were on a good album, they'd be all right, but they ain't good. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I like Chance a lot, but I'm not.
Yeah.
But like, I get it. It's okay. You know what? Chance is allowed to make 4 songs I don't like. It's fine.
Yeah.
I can move on. There's a million other things I can do with my time, and I don't have to buy them. I don't have to listen to them again. I don't have to. That's it. We are.
You can go listen to that Drake record.
It's also not good. it's also bad. There's also like, you know what's funny? Because if Drake's record had
been a string of bad hits,
if Drake had put out 4 songs, they were just the 4 good songs of his super long album, I'd be way happier. But no,
EPs like, exist for a reason.
The the irony is that the buying stuff is one of the places that like the people who get mad enough to send bomb threats to game developers actually have lots of power in terms of what they do and don't choose to buy. Increasingly with Steam, allowing you to do refunds and stuff like that, right? Those places, you have a lot of mobility. It's like changing the shape of the marketplace or interceding and saying maybe the world shouldn't be set up like a marketplace where people don't have much agency. It's inside of a marketplace. You're like, oh, I'm going to buy this and this. If you have access to something like Steam, if you're someone who's like, I'm going to spend $60 on a game, you actually have a fair degree of agency. It's just like that agency is meaningless when it comes to fixing your life or like improving your living conditions or anything like that, right? And so it's so weird to see those broader angers about the world or broader ideas about how the world works come to bear here where people get hurt, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe that's – do you have any other thoughts on this thing? Any other – I'm excited for No Man's Sky next. It's out next week. I'm super excited. I'm going to stream it a bunch probably because I cannot wait for it.
I'm excited for it. I have a history with No Man's Sky that I really dislike the first – you know, the onboarding, basically, of it. I really just liked the first hour and a half or so. And then I loved it for like 10, 15 hours. And then I didn't love it anymore, but I kept playing for another 10, 15 hours. I probably put about 30 hours into it, last August, 2 years ago in August.
Right.
And I really loved a lot of the things that game was going for. I really love that exploration. I really love the whole, it's sci-fi book covers that you walk around it. I love that shit. It was actually a lot of the mechanics, a lot of the sort of mining and inventory management that just absolutely put me off after a while. So I'm really excited to play.
And it sounds like that stuff is like, we didn't talk at all about what that game is going to be. We'll talk about that once it's out and we can talk about more. But like, yes, like there's a bit in here where he's like, so now you start the game and within your first hour or so, you're taught base building. And actually given the opportunity to just focus on that if you want. And then around hour 6 or 7, you get introduced to freighters and you get given your first freighter. You're seeing that stuff much earlier on. We brought forward vehicles and things like that. Like he talks later about there being a new sort of galactic marketplace whenever you're on a space station where it's like, hey, you know, before if you wanted to go buy a new ship, you had to wait for someone to land, walk over to it, talk to the pilot and be like, hey, can I buy your ship? And then you'd find out how expensive it was. And you'd be like, oh, I can never afford this. I got to go. And now it's like, no, there's just like a room where you go and you can buy stuff because that's how – video games work,
you know,
and things like that. There seems like there's gonna be lots of usability stuff. Apparently, it seems like it's gonna be pretty easy for us to play together if we want to play together, stuff like that. So I'm excited about that. We'll see. We will see next week. That's the thing that also makes this, these interviews make a lot of sense to me. Is like he's doing them four days before this game is out. This game is at Walmart now, and you know people are convincing Walmart employees to just like give them that game. Oh yeah, it says you can't sell. Yeah, that's no. It came out 2 years ago. It's just it's a bug. Just let me play it now, please.
It's a bug.
So people will be in the system, you know. People will probably be streaming this game this weekend illegally.
I'm sure.
Terrible illegal streamers. So you know, I think we'll see very soon whether or not this game is going to be for more people or not. Yeah. I'm curious.
Even if Patrick, of the funniest things about this piece, I only edited it in so far as I was doing typo passes, but I read it yesterday. And, like, at one point I, like, typed into our chat, I was just like, it's really funny how far you guys are taking this Patrick hates the game thing. Like, it was, like, a very cute, like, through line where, like, every other question there'd be, like, an aside either from Sean to Austin or Austin to Sean about, like, now I'm not saying this is for Patrick, but it just continues and continues. I don't know. I just thought that was pretty funny.
I represented, I think, a lot of people that – I will say, I came out of one of the demos for that game years ago when I was at Giant Bomb, and me and Vinny looked at each other and went, I don't think this game is the game I want it to be. And I was like, I'm just going to start setting my expectations differently because I don't think this is the space fantasy that I was looking for, which is fine. But I still give it a genuine shot. I played like 8 hours when it came out, but I didn't like chopping up for resources. Like, that's, I'm not really into those types of games, generally speaking, and the rest of it was not enough for me to stick around. So like a lot of that came from me being the kind of person that, like, had I paid, no, I think I did pay money for that. I don't know if I got a code for that or not. Either way, whether I paid for it or not, I bounced off it and just went, okay, I moved on to the next thing. But I am curious now, 2 years later. I did jump in and play like the Atlas Rises update, like before we did the interview.
Nice.
Played like 45 minutes and was but it's still
that game.
So I am curious to jump in with some maybe multiple. I don't know. Like, I've settled with it's not for me, but I always like coming back to it to wonder, like, okay, well, maybe there's a thread here I could pull on that I could keep pulling on that would allow me to enjoy the parts that I do enjoy. But I've more or less just concluded that it's okay, man. I got Hollow Knight and shit. Like, I'm good. Like, I don't need to like No Man's Sky to like feel full as a person.
You're No Man's Guy. Oh, sorry, that was an old ass idol thumbs
maybe,
reference.
Maybe
sorry.
I am. I don't know all the guys out there. Maybe I am one man's guy.
Yeah, you know, you like Dream Daddy. That was pretty good. So. Fair. All right.
Fuck Dream Daddy. I didn't get to go. I didn't get with my guy. I was friend zoned.
Right.
I was sent to the astral plane.
Dream Daddy butterflies.
Oh no. Maybe he just wasn't the guy though.
True.
You know, you weren't that man's guy. Is really the truth of the matter. I understand. You know.
Perfect.
I get it. Anyway, it's probably gonna do it for us. For episode 171. Of course, if you have questions, you can send them to gaming@device.com with the subject question. Shout outs always to Bowen for letting us use his track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. We're on Twitter @Waypoint. We're on Facebook @Waypoint Vice. We're on YouTube at Waypoint Vice. And of course, we're on Twitch, where you can see us doing our hot mic mornings and all of our Let's Plays at Waypoint, twitch.tv/Waypoint. And of course, you can read everything that we do, especially this new interview that just went up today at waypoint.vice.com. Austin, you got something to say.
I'm on Twitter at Austin_Walker.
Okay, good. Patrick,
that's it.
Where are you on Twitter?
That's all I got.
At Patrick Lumpick.
He like moved his face right next to the mic, and I was like, okay, he's ready. He's ready to tell us where he is on Twitter.
Twitter.com/Austin_Walker. You can find me there on my tweets about No Man's Sky, about Nintendo characters. I tweet sometimes about sports, but not often, just sometimes. I go, wow, it's a sports. Good sports game on. Like, I have some thoughts about that.
Are there music. Sports in No Man's Sky? Do you play a sport?
They added races. They're adding races, like multiplayer races.
What about basketball?
No, somewhere the universe is big. On some planet far away, there might be someone playing basketball. You probably won't see it.
Do you know what game has space basketball?
Space Jam.
Pray.
For the Saturn.
Space Jam for the Saturn.
It's a Sega Saturn. 1996's Space Jam for the Sega Saturn has space basketball in it.
That's, I actually kind of want to play that now.
I think it's 1996.
Kind of want to look that up. Anyway, thank you everyone for being wonderful. As always, I will remind you.
1997 in January, that's close to 1996.
Yeah, that's pretty close. It slipped. You know what? I hope they didn't crunch.
It's actually really sad. Oh, wait, no, that was in a different country. America, North America, November 26, 1996, just in time for the holidays.
It's in 1996, just in time. Yeah. Is that the big holiday game?
Yeah, that was the big one. Acclaim's Space Jam, starring Michael Jordan.
Space Jam.
I don't think Bill Murray was in the game.
Oh, shit. Couldn't get Bill Murray. Well.
Thanks, everybody. Twitter.com/Austin_Walker one more time. That's where you can find me on the internet for all of my takes.
I really like it. I'm really glad. Thank you for that gift. Namaste.
You're welcome.
Be good.
Is there a response to namaste? I don't know that.
I don't know.
Namaste.
Namaste. Okay. You just say it again. It's like bowing, I guess. It's like you just... The goddess in
me. I'm not saying that. That feels racist.
That's what namaste means.
How does it mean the goddess in me recognizes the goddess in you? Okay.
That's what they told us at yoga class in high school.
I don't believe you. Natalie is being...
Natalie, thank you. Thank you for sharing. I'm at Danielle Rai. And I
okay, yeah. In Hinduism, it means I bow to the divine in you.
I bow to the divine in you. Yeah, I like that.
No,
oh, okay.
All so right, sure.
In the context, I see.
You're not on the microphone. I don't think you're.
Sorry, right. Natalie went to an all-girls school, so it was goddesses.
Right.
But the gender-neutral version is divinity.
When you speak into a microphone, you have to make sure people hear you, Natalie. Okay? Sorry, it's just a tip. For more tips, you can go to twitter.com/Austin_Walker. Which is where I put all of my best tips.
Yeah, but I really want you to have space basketball tips. I'm really, like, upset that there
are dunks are easier.
Yeah.
Because you're in space. You can jump higher.
Can you do, like, cooler dunks because
yeah.
of it?
Yeah.
Like, can you, you do, don't get like, any more triple points, axles? Though.
Don't do that. Just dunk the ball and score and move on with your life. Yeah. It's yeah. not – you don't get kudos points. This isn't
– Are you sure?
What was the racing game with kudos points?
You get – kudos for delicious granola bars.
Metropolis Street Racer.
Metropolis. It's not, there you thank go. You, Patrick Klepek. Twitter.com/Patrick_Klepek. That's not right. I don't think that's where he lives.
Patrick Klepek.
That's where I go to talk about Metropolis Street Racer.
That's where you can find all the great MSR. New tips about Patrick_Klepek and Metropolis Street Racer. That's going to do it for me. Bye yeah. for me.
Bye, Austin. Thank you for giving us. You gave us a lot there. You gave us a gift. Once again, I say namaste. And I say to all of you, dear listeners, for sticking with us, be good and be good at it.
Peace. Bowen. Thank you, Bowen. Waypoint.zone/BOEN for all the latest tips about music.
About being
Bowen.
Bowen.
Be Bow and be Bowen.
At it.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.